It's always a little tempting to just sit here kind of cultivating no separation rather than say anything and kind of laughs it up. You know what I mean by no separation? Sitting here like this, I kind of feel all of you, and you me, but because of our tendency to complicate things, you may not realize that. You may think, well, this is just, you know, my ordinary crappy mind. You know, you may not appreciate how extraordinary your ordinary crappy mind is. You know, touches everything and is touched by everything. So, maybe to help us with that, we practice Zen. This funny thing we're doing here. It's kind of difficult for us to just kind of set everything down and just let life be life, and that's all. And because of our tendency to get active very easily, we can mistake how extraordinary everything is, just as it is. Oh, by the way, do people know what we were doing with the ceremony this evening? Was there an announcement, or did we announce anything? No, we didn't. There's no obligation, but would either of the people who made offerings like to say anything about the person who was remembered? You don't have to, but if you wish. No, not particularly. Okay. Anyway, some people close to Sangha members passed away. And this is one way we have of remembering them and giving them space in our hearts, and also kind of helping them on their way. The chant, the Daishin Tarani, is a magical spell meant to evoke the great compassionate one, who is, of course, all of us. And because it's magic, the words don't necessarily mean very much, although there are some specific expressions in there that are a little bit peculiar. Stuff about, may this blaze up, and oh, blue-necked one, and all this other kind of strange stuff, which comes from ancient times in India. And as it made its way east, the language changed. But so this is one version of this lengthy magical spell to bring forth this great heart of compassion, which is you know, touched by everything that lives and dies. And sometimes we make a special point of seeing this person died, this person died, and our compassion carry them forward to whatever is next for them. So that's what that was. And thank you for performing that powerful magic. As somebody told me recently that she was worried that maybe people at this sangha didn't know that as a practice they could receive Buddha's precepts. And I said, well, I kind of think they do. And so maybe there's some new people who don't know that, but mostly you're familiar with that, right? That you can ask to receive Buddhist precepts. Hmm. You've heard of that. Okay. You heard of it. Well, presumably, people who are wearing these small robes have heard of it. But you should know that it's available to everyone. And I've kind of inherited from my teacher that it's kind of a good thing for everyone to do. So you don't have to be, you know, like a really great Buddhist or I think your zazen's really good or something, to receive precepts. You can just ask. And then you know, some process will start. So feel free to do that if you feel inclined. And if you... well, we could talk a little bit about the precepts, what they are. And maybe people know a little bit about the story of... why we have, for instance, 16 precepts. Some other people have fewer, and some other people have a lot more. You know this?
Well, I have copies of the precepts on the back.
Oh, excellent. Well, maybe people could get them later, yeah, if they wish. That's helpful, thank you. Yeah, so we have 16, which is not a super long list. Another version, sometimes people take 5 precepts. Another one is sometimes people take 8 precepts. And then some other people take 250 if they're men, and 347 if they're women. Just like, oh, what is this? What kind of a mindset says that women need 147 more precepts? It's like, I don't get it. Well, that was one thing I actually heard. And the other thing I heard was, they need more protection. And I thought, that's a little bit funny.
It's only
97. Oh, thank you. My arithmetic was off. But that's quite a few. It's like, wait, they need 97 more precepts? Like, yeah, well, okay, whatever. And if you read them, some of them are very strange. But I won't go into that right now. But anyway, these both represent, these various ways represent different fashions of giving some shape to our ethical life in the Sangha. Right? It's like, if it has no shape at all, that's in a way, that's okay. But sometimes people find that kind of difficult and confusing, and they feel like they don't have any particular guidance in like ethical situations. So for quite a while, the arrangement was that you would enter the Sangha and you would become a bhikshu, a mendicant, or bhikshuni, And you would receive a bunch of precepts, which get very detailed about your life and things you have and things you do and a lot of things you don't do, must not do. So one approach was that as the Sangha lived and practiced together, they say in Buddhist time, but it's not clear exactly how all of this developed. It's probably unlikely that Buddha himself came up with 250 things and said, okay, you do all these. But the story was that people just lived together at first, and then as time went on, people would do stuff, and sometimes some other people would say, that's really weird, and they'd go to Buddha and say, those people are doing blah, blah. And Buddha would often say, okay, we'll have this rule, no blah, blah. And this went on for quite a while until you had 250 rules. But if you read them, you notice that some of them, no offense, are a little ridiculous to get so specific and to think that with 250 rules you've hit all the points. It's like, no, you have not. Nor with 347 have you. But one approach is to put a lot of kind of markers out there to kind of help people know where they are in the ethical universe. That was one way. And after a while, well, like maybe quite a while, it's not entirely clear, but maybe in the 8th century or so, some people started saying, maybe this isn't quite so useful. What if we were to kind of compress that down into a shorter list, which nevertheless delineates an ethical universe in just as serious a fashion, but in less detail. So some people started practicing that way with ethical life. And one version that came up was, well, what if we have 16 precepts, that is 16 guides for ethical life, and why don't we try that? And so that way became established. That's the way we've inherited. And if you look at those 16, they actually do draw for us a map of ethical life that's pretty effective. And for many people, it's a bit more useful than trying to get super, super specific and think of everything that anyone could ever do that was a little off and make that a rule. No. It's like, okay, maybe that's one approach. But what if we say, well, first of all, how about we say everyone should go for refuge? Right? You know that. Right? Usually one of the first things Buddhists encounter is this notion of going for a refuge. So among our 16 precepts, the first three are the three refuges. And the Sanskrit word is sharanam. That means a place of safety, right? Or saranam in Pali. And the formula is, I go to Buddha as a place of safety. I go to the enlightened one to help me find my light so that I can illuminate the world for all beings. And I go to Buddha's teaching as a place of safety to educate my body mind about what that means. And then I go to the community of all practitioners as my place of safety within which this important work takes place. So those are the three refuges. Yeah? I know a lot of you know all this stuff, but maybe it's okay to visit it once in a while. And then you have these very strange so-called pure precepts. We've got three of those, so we have three refuges. We have three pure precepts. And those are, it's interesting, they're called pure precepts because you can't really get a toehold in them. There are not a lot of little cracks for us to stick stuff in, you know, to fuss with. They're very hard to fuss with because they are so enormous. Okay. So anybody know what they are, the pure precepts? There are various versions, but anybody to volunteer? Yes. That's one. That's kind of number three, at least in certain formulas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh. Right. So, as I say, that's a very huge net. I vow to embrace and sustain upright conduct, which means, I don't know, conduct that does not harm myself or other beings or confuse people, cause confusion or fear or anger. Right? That's upright conduct. So, okay, do all that. And then I vow to embrace and sustain refraining from all evil. Like, okay. Again, anything that is harmful, I won't do. Right? It's a huge net, right? The whole world is in there. And then I vow to embrace and sustain all beings. So my life will be for everything that lives. And remember the Tibetan saying, everyone dies, but no one is dead. So all living things is all beings, basically. Because all beings are alive, even though they die and are born. So this is so-called pure precepts, which again, hard to get a foothold in there, which is what they're for. So again, now we have this huge net, which is encompassing a whole ethical universe. And then they have 10 more. So we got 6, and then there are 10 more, which are sometimes called the clear mind precepts. And they are specifically to soothe the body mind so that one can cultivate reality in stillness the way we do here. And it's pretty easy to experiment with this in one's own life and see that if one kind of lives contrary to these 10, I don't know, principles, one's body mind is far less likely to be at rest. Right? So do we know what those are? What is it? I take a vow not to kill. I take a vow not to take what isn't given. Right? So no killing, no stealing, no possessive, exploitative, or imprisoning sexuality. Right? None of those. Right? False, misleading speech. Right? And then, deliberate fogging of the body mind. Right? No deliberate blunting of the body mind. Yes?
Interesting about that one.
Yeah.
I'd love to define what I define as the oldest existence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, not to sell the wine of delusion is one expression. And, of course, you could say, well, that only meant wine. But actually, wait, no, there's all this other stuff.
Just rice wine.
Yeah, right. There's whiskey and champagne and, you know, all these other things. So what it means is do not foster the befogged minds of others, right? Or yourself, yes?
Doesn't it also refer to intoxication of views, i.e. holding one's opinions lightly?
That is sometimes an interpretation, yes. sometimes the fifth precept is interpreted as a general warning about intoxication. And there are all kinds of intoxication. We can get intoxicated with an idea, with another person, with wine, with chocolate, with politics. I mean, you name it, right? So this is a guideline about being aware of the tendency to become intoxicated, right? Such that the natural, the brilliant clarity of the body-mind is clouded. Yeah? And let's see, where are we now? Five? I think the next one is to refrain from propagating the misdeeds of others is one way it is sometimes put. So it's like spreading the bad news, pointing the finger at others and say, they're really bad. Now, this raises the question, is it ever necessary actually to do that? And I would say yes. There are times when it is necessary to say, watch out for what's going on over here. So, whether that is making light of the sixth precept, I don't know. I wouldn't say so. But it is something to be careful of. Let's see, what's the next one? That one is, I will refrain from kind of raising or increasing myself and diminishing others. And that's, you know, it's not so hard to do, actually. We might find ourselves in various situations where it's very tempting to go kind of, those people, not so good. Me, yeah, really good. And this tendency, again, is distorting, right, of relations in the Sangha, and also is a way of fogging our mind, right? Confusing ourselves about just this person. Yeah. So where are we now? And I think the next one is that I will refrain from being acquisitive. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah. I will refrain from the mind, from cultivating the mind of acquisition. Okay. Acquisitive. Yeah. Cultivating the mind of acquisition. Right. So where are we now? Yeah. The next one is, I will not create in this body mind a place for ill will. Okay? I will not cultivate a place of ill will in my body mind. Right? Wishing harm to others. I have found that one somewhat difficult in the current political climate. So I have to work with that a lot. So, oops, stop that. Stop it. And then the last one is, I will not abuse, disparage, or take advantage of the three treasures, which were my place of refuge at the beginning. Okay? So these are so-called the 16 bodhisattva precepts. And they are a distillation of other longer lists. And if someone, for instance, is maybe interested in receiving those precepts, the receiving part is like, it's like a ceremony in which a person announces that they are making those precepts the principles of their own ethical life, and they want the whole universe to know it. So this is an announcement. I shall, from here on in, live this way. And I invite anyone to comment. Actually, that's kind of fine print. Like, you invite anyone to say, you know, actually, that's not going so well. Or maybe sometimes, actually, you're doing pretty good. Either way, we don't want to get, you know, too depressed or too excited. But it's actually okay if the universe comments back to us and says, way to go, or not so good. So the ceremony is when one stands up and says, this is how I'm going to live. So in terms of actually receiving the precepts, you could say that everyone here has done so this evening. Anyone who has listened to this description and has taken those in has already received the precepts. And then maybe at some point it will be appropriate for a ceremony announcing that. So if people feel so inclined, they should talk to Jim. You know, and we'll see what happens. Then usually it's thought to be helpful to give people a kind of a garment to wear, which kind of says, I'm living this way. If you need a hand, come talk to me. You know, I am available. If you're having a terrible time in your ethical life, why don't we have a chat? You know, I am a beacon for other beings, which is a little bit intimidating, but you know, that's how it works. That's why there's a garment like this to wear rather than just, you know, well, nothing at all, which most of us don't wear this around all day. Some people do, and like if you go to Japan, sometimes you see people wear these all day, but mostly people don't. So at least sometimes it's good to say, I'm wearing Buddha's robe so that people will know I am trying to live that way and that they can too. It's also kind of a way of saying, this is also scary, it's kind of a way of saying, I am not dangerous. Maybe that's a lot nowadays to be able to say, I am not dangerous. You need not be afraid of me. That's kind of good if you can do that. So as I say, there are these other approaches, and some people are more comfortable if they have a great many other rules, even if some of them are very strange. Like if you read in detail the 250 precepts, you may find yourself wondering, as I have, what were they thinking back then to come up on? Anyway, never mind. But if you check it out, you may also find yourself bemused by how many things they thought they had to say, don't do this. Okay, so I guess I just wanted people to know that this is available, that by simply hearing and allowing those precepts to enter your heart, your body, mind, you've received them. And if you, at some point, want to alert the universe to that, we can have a ceremony, if you want. Okay, so are there questions about that? Anybody have any questions? Comments? Yes.
It seems to me that it's not rare that if there is so much available, but so little that is encouraged, it's as if we're waiting in hope
of people to say, can I too hold a microphone?
Uh-huh.
Or whatever. You know, I'm wondering why that is. I'm wondering why I'm not encouraged to eat my vegetables and use sunblock.
Well, but aren't you encouraged to eat your vegetables and eat sunblock?
But I'm speaking of the menu within the Buddhist Dharma.
Oh, you mean why isn't there more to it? Like you should eat your vegetables and take care of your skin?
I am quite new to Buddhism. I found it in the autumn of 2016.
Oh.
And I'm not a reader.
Okay.
I call myself a player.
Okay.
Uh-huh. You know, I would rather hike a mountain and play a piano than study chemistry or the Dharma.
Very good.
Read a book.
Mm-hmm.
But I very much appreciate a map. Mm-hmm. I appreciate this is what you have to do to become a doctor.
Uh-huh.
This is what you have to do to become an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you have to do to presumably live to be 85 years old.
Uh-huh.
And
maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, to give yourself the best chance. I'm looking for the low-lying fruit.
Okay.
You know, I myself care a lot about being fit, but I don't care about being the fastest. I just want to be able to run a marathon, as I call it, with power and grace. Those are my goals, and I try to ignore the clock, and I try to pick the low-lying fruit towards running with power and grace.
Okay.
And I would love to be encouraged by members of my Sangha here to say, you know, you really probably ought to read that book three times before you read this other book for the first time, or you know, just to have a map, a yellow brick road, so to speak.
Okay. Well, I just described a map of ethical life, so there's one. So you could take that away this evening, and that's a part of the of whatever it is you're constructing for yourself inside. Okay. And I don't know about reading. You told us you're not much of a reader, so I don't know if I'd say, "Oh, you ought to read that book," and then read those two. I mean, maybe, but you don't have to. Yeah.
I hope, in all my verbosity, my question didn't get lost, and I'm afraid it did. In short, I'm wondering why don't we, in general, offer maps of encouragement?
Ah, okay. I guess I sort of feel like we do, but maybe not enough. Maybe that's something to consider. Especially if someone says, "I'd like a little more encouragement here," then maybe we should offer that. Yes.
Thanks, Peter. Is that is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't that what a relationship with a teacher is? Is that one avenue?
Among other things, yeah.
What would be other avenues?
Just relationships within the Sangha. Relationships with the Sangha that includes everybody, not just people in this room, but people everywhere in our life and people everywhere that we meet. There's the readily identifiable Sangha, and then there's kind of what's called the universal Sangha, in which basically all beings participate. So in that way, every meeting in our life is a possible encouragement for us and for the other party. And if that is how we're living, whether we know it or not, that's really great. And maybe that's what's happening. We don't know necessarily, but we have some encounter with somebody and they go away thinking, "Well, that was kind of nice. That's really great, actually, in our world." So that's an avenue of encouragement, especially for others. And the particular kind of cultivation that goes on between so-called teacher and so-called student is another avenue.
And it's an active rather than a passive activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a question mark at the end of that.
Yeah. Well, I guess considering my relationship with my teacher, and there were more active moments and some more passive moments, so it was kind of a whole thing. Yeah. A whole mishpucha, as they say. Yes, Ivana?
It seems to me that Buddhists in general tend to not appreciate dogma and proselytizing. I might be projecting a lot of my own feelings saying that. So I think that's one explanation for why we don't offer a lot of maps, like here's a map, you know. We kind of tend to, at least I do, and I appreciate it when others do, the person reaches a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, here's the map you might be interested in.
Yeah. My impression is kind of Suzuki Roshi did that. He didn't necessarily go after people. I know that my teacher cultivated a very close relationship as much as he could with Suzuki Roshi, mostly by kind of being in the way. So he'd like hang out outside Suzuki Roshi's room. And Suzuki Roshi would come out and there's Red. Hi. You know, and as a result, he got kind of, you know, periodically Suzuki Roshi would say, come in here, I'm going to teach you about chanting or teach you about this or that. And he did that by basically being in the way. So, pretty much nobody went after him. Nobody chased my teacher around, you know. And in fact, there were some occasions where my teacher kind of went after Suzuki Roshi, and he kind of said, thanks, and shut the door. Like he was going to go to, Suzuki Roshi had said something about, I was thinking maybe you would go to Japan, and Red was like, yes, go to Japan, yes. So he went to the consulate or something and got these visa papers, and went and knocked on Suzuki Roshi's door and said, I got the visa papers. Suzuki Roshi looked at them, took them away, said thank you, shut the door, and that was the end of it. So it was a very Japanese approach. It's like, you don't do that. You wait for me to say, right? Then I will give you a map. So put yourself there where I can see you, and then we'll see what happens. But I'm not going to chase you. And if you chase me, I may say, bye. So that's just one way.
Yes. What if a person is having some difficulty with one of the precepts? They'd like to receive the precepts.
Yes.
But they pretty much know in their heart that it would not be right to take to receive them because they would be immediately in violation.
Oh, violation is assumed. Yeah.
I'm receiving encouragement right at the moment.
Yeah. Violation is presumed, right? That's one reason you take the precepts,
okay.
Knowing that this is going to be an ongoing engagement with these ethical principles. And that's one of the reasons for saying, hello, universe, I'm doing this, see, 16, so that the universe can go back and say, no, that was not good at all, that one. And you realize, oh, yeah, renewed effort. But even in renewing the effort, there's the understanding that this is not about, okay, I have attained perfection in numbers 1, 6, 9, you know, that's not how it works. It's like, take them all on and quote, break, unquote, all of them. You know, as, you might say, as needed, as happens. And then the reason they're there is so you can say, oh, actually, I said there was a line, and now I just walked over it. And if that line weren't there, maybe I wouldn't have noticed. But now I noticed. That's practicing the precepts. And that is enough reason to receive them. Yeah. Also, I think Givon had a question.
I was going to say that I think, too, our maps don't quite look like other people's maps. You know, our chanting, which Mio mentioned, chanting is a way to enter into this life.
Mm-hmm.
And also our sitting. We have half-day, one-day sits that Jim leads and various other people we have here. So that's also an opportunity. So there's lots of different maps that lead us different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Just kind of going off of what, can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Off what Larry said, what I've learned from these precepts too, I think I relate with you on these quite a bit. is it's taught me how to be more intentional with why I do certain things, or when it happens, at least I go, is it really something I want to do? Or is it maybe I should not this time?
Mm-hmm.
Or what is the real intention for doing this now?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've noticed in my practice, is mm-hmm. just trying to notice it and not beat myself up. Because for yeah. years and years and years, I've always been like, I'm terrible at this and mm-hmm. beat myself up. But now I'm trying to be a little bit more gentle
mm-hmm.
and a little bit more understanding of the precepts and really understand yeah. the intention of it, I should say, mm-hmm. and really try to find where that is.
Mm-hmm.
And apply that, and by just keeping that in my mind and going forward and saying, okay, I'm going to try and practice these now, because I was for a long time the same way. I'm not going to ever take these things because
yeah.
it's just like a pointless endeavor.
That's the point. Yes, right.
But
yeah.
we're all gonna fault. We're not perfect. You know, some are gonna be better than others, of course. But that's what for me. It's brought more mindfulness
right.
and attention to each of those
yeah.
to kind of work on those and see
yeah.
my true intention in that.
Yeah. Well, this is what's called practicing with the precepts. And that is as good a reason as any to receive them formally, I would say. So generally, if someone says to me, I want to receive the precepts, I kind of look at their life and see if I can see them practicing with them. And if I can, I say, yeah, great, let's do that. And sometimes I can't really, so I say, well, let's talk about it a little bit more. First of all, do you know what they are? And sometimes people say, no. So I say, well, how about first, learn the list, and then we'll see how you're practicing with them. And then at some point, maybe we'll say, okay, good, let's do this. Some people are have a more definitive map about it. So they'll say, well, if you're interested in receiving the precepts, you have to do this and this and this, and take such and such a class, and go to such and such a retreat and read these things. And I don't necessarily say that. So, but there are people who say that kind of thing if you would prefer. Okay. Yes.
So when you're ordained as a priest, is it the same precepts? Are there? I'm just curious, what's the difference from lay ordination and priestly ordination?
The precept list is the same, and the methods of observance are more complicated. So one's wardrobe becomes more complicated, and the, you might say, signals sent out to the world, to the universe, about one's practice become a little bit more explicit and elaborate. So it's basically the same saying, I am practicing this way, but the exposure is a little higher, right? And as a result, the critique is sometimes a little sharper. So that's, I would say, the main difference.
In priest ordination, I mean, I've never seen one. So, is there an explicit, like, this is my vocation now, or I mean, like, is that a difference?
I would say that's implied by the conferring of monastic equipment on the person and monastic garb. So that's kind of implied. Right? Now there are places where clergy only wear that kind of clothing. In the West here, that isn't so well established. Some people do that, but a lot of people don't. We don't have that tradition. So if you see somebody wandering around in robes, it's a little bit like, what is that weirdo doing? And some people like that, and other people find it off-putting. So in the West here, all of that is still being formed. I did notice that somebody I know who only wears robes and wanders around in them a lot seems to have just acquired an enormous old Catholic monastery to practice in. How did he do that? How come I can't do that? Anyway, maybe wandering around in robes all the time is part of it. But usually when I've tried that, it hasn't necessarily been very helpful. It kind of structures interactions in a way that is a little weird sometimes. You know, people relate to you as like, well, this is kind of, why does this person think I'm like real special? or real holy. I'm not any of that stuff. I do tell this story about when I took a plane to New York the month after 9/11, and everybody was very nervous. It was like this very tense feeling on the aircraft and in the whole airport, actually. And I was kind of feeling that too. It was like, oh, this is kind of weird. But I was wearing robes. And when I got on the plane, I was walking to my seat, and a woman just grabbed my arm and said, "I am so glad you're on this plane." I went, gulp, and I said, well, I'm glad you're on this plane too. So that kind of thing happens more often, and sometimes it's helpful, and other times it's just weird. So I tend to kind of lean in the slightly more Western monastic garb sort of way, and sometimes that's more helpful, but sometimes not, so. Well, you're all very patient, and you're also so quiet when we were sitting. You know, too bad that bell rang. You're all so still. Thank you very much, and please take care of yourselves, and we'll see you again.